This is KUCR Radio, 88.3 FM in Riverside. And this is Walter of the Woods. This is a special edition of Psyched Electronics. Normally we just do music around here, but we have decided to go a little deeper. So we're going to be speaking with a special guest that we have brought into the KUCR studios, and that would be Jan Irvin.
Well, thanks for having me here, Walter, and I'll see if I can make this an interesting show for you guys.
You have a couple of books, or a few books, and also a DVD.
Well, I have one book in print now, and another one that's due out in the next couple of months. The first book that I did is actually gone through revision and is due for a second edition later on this year, too.
Okay, so let's talk about...
As well as the DVD.
So what you talk about in this research has to do with astrotheology and shamanism, and also what you call the Pharmacratic Inquisition. Can you give us an idea of what is astrotheology and how does that relate to shamanism, and what also is shamanism?
Yeah, okay, that's a loaded couple of questions there. Astrotheology is really religion based on the observation of celestial objects as well as the sun and the moon. Most of the ancient religions were based on sun and lunar worship in one form or another. From there, it expands out to the anthropomorphisms of the constellations. Everybody's familiar with the different constellations. You've got Orion, and you've got Virgo, and all of the ancient gods of the heavens. And astrotheology in these ancient cultures, the stars are what controlled their lives, basically. And so they would anthropomorphize the constellations in order to... tell the stories of the stars and the constellations, which the main part of it was to create myths that they would pass down generation after generation. But the reasoning behind the myths was that ancient cultures didn't have a calendar on the wall or on the desktop of their computer that they clicked on and, oh, today's Thursday, let's go plant our crops, you know. Back then, they had to know what was happening in the sky. And, of course, there wasn't the light pollution that we have today. Back during the, I think it was, 94, during the Northridge earthquake, when all the electricity went out, Griffith Observatory started receiving thousands of phone calls because of objects in the sky, and it took them a while to figure out what these objects were that people were calling in about. And there was something called stars. So our society isn't even really aware of the stars for the most part. You know, most people are ignorant of the constellations and their whereabouts and things like that. But there were certain phenomena that took place in the sky that these ancient cultures tracked so that they would know when to plant and harvest and store food and things like that. Because if they didn't, they perished. And you don't want to be planting your crop in the middle of winter and then it's late fall and then suddenly it freezes over and then guess what? Your whole tribe dies. So that's really how... let me go back a second. The astrotheology is really something under what we today called archaeoastronomy. And in fact, going back to Griffith Observatory, the director of Griffith Observatory, Dr. E.C. Krupp, he is a famous author writing about archaeoastronomy and its ties to shamanism as well. Basically, the ancient shamans were the ones who kept this knowledge, and eventually the shamans became the priests, and then the priests took over, the churches took over the knowledge of the stars and the heavens, and they would do things like predict an eclipse, which was simple mathematics, and they would get lots of people to believe that they had control of God and that they could make the sun disappear in the middle of the day and things like that. And these were really techniques that were used by a lot of the priests later on to manipulate and control humankind for their own aggrandizement, and so that's I think a decent summary of astrotheology, and astro being star, theo being God, and logi being the study of, or the word of. So it's the word or the study of how the ancients revered the stars as gods. Shamanism, that's a deep issue. And the word shamanism is very generic today. It's sort of picked up. You go into any New Age bookstore and you'll see a ton of books on shamanism, and they talk about crystals and finding your animal ally and things like that. But, you know, historically speaking, some of those things may have taken a minor role in what is shamanism. But shamanism really comes out of the Siberian region, as at least the word shaman or saman comes from the region of Siberia, the Norse, Ostiak, Samoyedes tribes, and several others who use specifically Amanita muscaria, psychedelic mushrooms, for their journeying. And the word saman, what we use as shaman, is basically the one who knows, the one with the knowledge. Today, what has happened with shamanism is it's sort of become a generic term and sort of adopted by anybody who thinks they're studying what is holistic and spiritual. And so it's really a very dogmatized version of what shamanism is. There's a woman, Alice Kehoe, she wrote a book called Shamanism, that she argues that the word shaman should not be used for any group other than the Siberian shamans, because the role in Siberia today of the shamans and the original people who use this word have been so largely marginalized by the Russian government, and most of them have been wiped out and been forced into white, westernized societies and things like that, and they've really lost a lot of their culture. And she argues that shamanism, using that word as a whole, sort of perpetuates that, but she doesn't really give us a good substitute on what we should call all of these different cultures. Today, the word shamanism, as it's more technically referred to, is any culture who uses psychedelic substances, whether it be mushrooms, peyote, ayahuasca, iboga, salvia divinorum in its original context, and many, many other entheogenic or psychedelic plants that were out there that facilitated today what we call entheogens, which means to generate the god within, entheogen. And that's really the more technical term of the plants and their use today. They're not really, the word hallucinogen has been pretty much thrown out because they've never been able to prove that the visions that people see on these things are hallucinations. And study after study has shown that there is something deeper. In fact, Professor Benny Shannon, earlier this year from the University of Israel, published his thesis that Judaism was based on a cult that was using an ayahuasca analog, which is, and he argues, was most likely Paganum harmala, which is the Syrian rue seed, and the acacia leaves. And we know that these are plants that were widely available in the Mediterranean, Middle East region, and Paganum harmala has a long history of use, and acacias are sort of worshipped, and you can't, because of the strict suppression of these societies in that region, you can't really find a culture that still uses it, but you can find traces that we can hypothesize that these things were used there. So that's sort of, to go back to Benny Shannon's thesis for a second, he basically, in a book called Antipodes of the Mind, he went down to the Amazon basin and did, originally, ayahuasca, he did 120 times. Now he's done over 160 times on himself. And this is a professor, the top professor of psychiatry at the University of Israel. And his thesis was published by Oxford, and it's a top-notch academic publication, and he totally refutes the notion that these substances are producing hallucinations. In fact, he had to develop a new model of psychiatry because of the discoveries that he found with ayahuasca. And he starts out in the book trying to debunk the experience as just a chemical reaction in the brain. And by the end of the book, he has to throw out every assumed classification of these substances. And they came to the conclusion by the end of the book that there's just no way that we can define it as just a mere hallucination. So that sort of gives you a summary of global shamanism and astrotheology and everything in a not-so-nutshell form.
How did you become interested in these things?
Well, it sort of actually happened not far from here. Originally, I was I grew up in Redlands, about 20 minutes from here, and I had liked to party in high school, got in trouble smoking pot, got suspended for school for 3 days for smoking pot in high school, and my parents flipped out, the typical routine. And
so you got into trouble.
Got into trouble
for messing around with a plant.
Messing around with a flower, you know, and it was just, I'm like, it's a flower. What's, you know, my mom grew roses. I'm like, what's the big deal, you know? But in all seriousness, I was going to Crafton Hills College, and I was taking French class, and, you know, I was going to go sneak off to my car, and there's this older gentleman in my class. His name was Chuck Conrad, and he was in his 50s at the time, and he's like, you know, you wouldn't be going to your car to smoke pot by chance. And I kind of looked at him like, you know, this guy's old enough to meet my grandfather. Why do you ask? Well, because I'd like to join you. You know, and I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that is actually what I was planning on doing. Sure, you know, and I'm like just all freaked out. Anyway, this guy and I became friends for like 15 years. He died a couple years ago. And he used to always listen to this radio station called KPFK, and not this radio station. This is KUCR, everybody. But so Jack Hare was announcing on KPFK that he was doing training for the California Hemp Initiative. This is back in like 93, and that he was going to be training everybody to collect signatures for the California Hemp Initiative. And so we called the number and says, yeah, you know, when can you come on down? And we go down there, and it ends up being at Jack's house, you know. And Jack Hare, the author of The Emperor Wears No Clothes, and I just, wow, you know. And so we go down there, and I meet Jack, and I grab a few, 3 or 4 pages of petition sheets, and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to have a handful of my friends sign it, and I've done my civic duty, and off I go, right? Wrong. So the next day, I get a call from Jack. And he says, I just caught my Inland Empire coordinator stealing, and I need a new coordinator. You're the only person I know out there. You're it. And I'm like hanging up the phone, looking at it like one of those TV moments where the guy's looking at the phone, you know. And so I'm looking at the phone, and I'm hanging up just going, what the heck did I just agree to? And so that sort of set me on an entirely new course of life. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up being the Inland Empire coordinator. I set up numerous rallies at Cal State San Bernardino, Crafton Hills College, UCR, and San Bernardino Valley, RCC. And, you know, so I started interacting with Jack a lot, and he started teaching me a lot of the things that he knew. And maybe I'll throw out there that even RCC arrested me illegally for petitioning, and 7 other police officers had felonies against them. But that was a fun thing. When
did you get beat up?
They tried to beat me up. They had me handcuffed to the chair in the police station when the police chief came in and got on his knees and said, well, what would you think if I said I'm going to let you go and not press charges? And I looked at him and I said, what would you say if I know that you realize how bad you just screwed up? I didn't use quite those words, and that each officer involved today has a felony count against them. And he just kind of went, his mouth kind of dropped open, and, you know, so he begged us to please come back the next day and to please do everything over again, and that there would be no hindrance upon us whatsoever, and yada yada, you know. And after that, very shortly after that, I had... you know, done a couple of speeches here, and then Jack calls me up one day and he says, hey, you know, down at Chapman University, they're doing a big talk. All of these researchers on psychedelic drugs are going to be coming. I'm like, well, what's hemp got to do with that? And I kind of didn't really get it. And, you know, that day I met Timothy Leary and I met Dennis McKenna, the famed Terrence McKenna's brother, and all of these other researchers. And I walked out of there that day going, huh, I'm missing something. And a friend of mine had given me two of Terrence McKenna's tapes, and they were, you know, in my glove box, and I'm driving home, and one of the talks was Food of the Gods, and the other was True Hallucinations that I've since released on the internet with about 70 hours of other McKenna material. And I'm driving back, and he says, well, you know, if you do 5 to 7 grams in silent darkness, you'll see God. And I'm like, I tripped in high school. That's crap. I'm going to prove that wrong. So I call up my local friend and swung by his house on the way home and got a quarter of these things. And I went home and unplugged everything in my house, which I hadn't done before. It was always in the partying teenage sort of setting. And I decided to do the cave style shamanic way that this guy said. I'm like, okay, this is ridiculous. But, you know, let's humor this guy and I'm going to debunk this. So 8 hours later, I realized that... that all of my previous experiences with these substances, I hadn't, as Terrence McKenna said at the time, if you haven't done 7 grams of psilocybe cubensis in in silent darkness, you've never been past the front door of the house of psychedelics, much less examine the attic and the basement and the backyard and all of this other stuff. So I'm like going, okay, so the door opened that night, and it set me on a much deeper path of research. And then again, Jack here had this book that he always talked about, and everybody had sort of dismissed it. It had been marginalized. It was by this famed Dead Sea Scroll scholar named John Marco Allegro. And Allegro wrote a book in 1970 called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And he argued in this book that the Judeo-Christianity was based on a drug fertility cult. And everybody just sort of poo-pooed his work, and which I'll go into more later. But and it was largely dismissed, especially by the academic community, and it basically cost Allegro his career. And we're talking a top-notch Dead Sea Scroll scholar, you know, and he was always on the fringe because he would never toe the line. The other Dead Sea Scrolls translators, almost all of them were all Catholic priests. And he had started out as a Methodist minister, training for the Methodist ministry, and realized that when he was studying languages that he started questioning his religious convictions, and which eventually led him to another researcher from England, John Ramsbottom. He was the professor of the London Botanical Museum, and he had written a book, Mushrooms and Toadstools, back in 1953, that had mention of mushrooms possibly being related to religion and things like this. And so Allegro, researching that, came out with this thesis in The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross that Judeo-Christianity was no different than all of these shamanic cultures, and that that a lot of the characters in the Bible were actually anthropomorphisms of this mushroom, and not, they weren't stories about a real person. And so that kind of got me questioning things, Allegra had argued that Jesus was never a real man, that he was part of the mushroom fertility symbolism, and that the Jesus Christ was never a physical person. And in fact, there is no evidence that Jesus was a historical person outside the Bible. Most unbiased academics pretty much unanimously, unless they have their, you know, roots set in the faith, in their own faith, and they have to prove their own faith to justify what they do for a living. If they're not in that category, they pretty much unanimously agree that there's no evidence that Jesus was a historical character, or that there's, you know, there's just no evidence to support it. And so that was what Allegro argued, and it took me about 8 years after that, continuing my research, to come to the conclusion that Allegro was correct, that there just wasn't any substantial evidence of the majority of the so-called events in the Bible even being historical. You know, the Exodus from Egypt, it would have been like 30 or 40% of Egypt's population, and there's absolutely no record in Egypt about this so-called mass exodus of Jews. And we're talking one of the most literate ancient cultures on earth, and not a single private letter written to anybody, not a pyramid text, not a nothing. And so, you know, I started looking at all of these angles and saying, you know, maybe if I just switch off for a moment my own belief, because I had been raised Christian, I went to a private Christian school as a kid, and so maybe if I decide to turn off my own convictions, heresy, blasphemy, that maybe I'll start seeing this research from a different angle. So I just, you know, tried it out and started looking through the scripts and everything, and I was like, wow, you know, if I stop trying to literalize these stories, suddenly they all start making a heck of a lot more sense. And suddenly I could apply this story to this story to this story, and they would all be uniform. And then I started looking at other religions. Well, if this is true here, well, then what if we applied this to Hinduism or to, you know, to Buddhism or to Mithraism or to Native American shamanism? And point after point, there were, you know, when I stopped looking at the differences and started focusing on the similarities, that was when I really started snowballing in the research and finding that indeed these characters weren't real historical any more than the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy or Zeus. You know, it's all ancient mythology. And then I started looking at, well, you know, there's differences. This story doesn't really apply to a mushroom. What does it apply to? And then I came across astrotheology, and I started looking at that. You know, and a lot of people like to try to debunk astrotheology's ties to Christianity. And the interesting thing that I've found is that the primary attackers against the idea of astrotheology and Judeo-Christianity haven't even read the books. You know, what they do is they'll watch Zeitgeist and they'll see one mistake and they'll say, oh, well, all of Acharya S.'s research must be wrong, or all of this person's research must be wrong because this film producer over here made one mistake, or, you know, something to that effect. In fact, just this week I've gotten three emails from different people about this new movie online that says, that's basically saying astrotheology is BS, and they show one of our old pictures from our website in this video. And I, you know, after the third letter, I'm like, all right, I better watch this thing, see what this guy is saying. And he was basically taking a split screen image that where we showed on the top of the image we showed the evening, Christmas Eve, and then on the bottom part of the shot we showed Christmas morning. Well, this guy takes this as supposed to mean, you know, one image, you know, you can see Orion and Sirius along with the rising sun in the morning. He didn't even read the text, understand what the picture was describing, you know. So he thinks, oh, you know, this is all hooky. And, of course, you know, I've yet to come across anybody who attacks this research who has actually read it. And that's sort of been my drive lately is, you know, and I've made a rule on my website on the forum that if you attack an author's research that you haven't read, you'll be warned and then you'll be banned, you know, because, you know, our work is about getting to the truth. And if you don't even have the tenacity to read the work before you attack it so that you have a firm understanding of what the author is presenting, then that's not intellectual honesty, and it's not something that we need to waste our time with. So anyway.
So how did we get to the conception of the Christian religion and that we have today? How come there is the disconnect between the astrotheology and our conception of what Christianity is about?
Well, in 325, the Roman Catholic Church, actually, it was just really sort of forming at that time, but Emperor Constantine held the ecumenical council, the Council of Nicaea. And this was where the Christians get their Nicene Creed from, all of the things that are supposed to be Jesus, and all the Christians repeated every Sunday at church, and these are all the things that a Christian is supposed to believe. You know, Jesus did this, he did that. And basically what they did at this Council of Nicaea was they called together roughly 300 of the world's leading minds at the time and sort of pooled together a universal or Catholic religion. And that's, in fact, what the word Catholic means. It means universal. And, of course, Rome was going to be, by divine will, the Roman emperor was going to be in control of this new universal or one-world religion. And initially, Rome was pretty open to other religions and allowing a diversity. And somewhere along the line, a lot of the people started taking the religious Christian fanaticism to a literal point, and then they started going around and burning libraries and killing, you know, women, people who had power, educators like Hypatia in Alexandria. She was one of the first people that was killed by the Christian fanatist crusades, if you want to call it that, at that early a point. But she was, you know, she was one of the people that worked at the Great Library of Alexandria, and they even went so far as to take seashells and scrape every single piece of meat from her bones in the streets as they killed her, and then burned her so that there was nothing left, and then the Christians celebrated in the streets. So this is the first form of the suppression and the Inquisition aspect of this knowledge. And then
what was motivating them to
fear. It's always fear, you know, and it's like, well, their God must be right, and because the Bible says so, and I think even at that point the Bible hadn't even been solidified. What solidified the Catholic Church to create what is today the Bible was the Marcion Bible, and the Catholic hierarchy was so floored by the Marcion Bible, because Marcion basically was a Gnostic, and he said that Jesus didn't exist, that he wasn't a historical character, and they didn't put this everything as literal fact and truth in the Marcion Bible. So that was really what got the Catholic Church motivated to put a Bible together, you know, and that's why we have four Gospels, because they eliminated out the Gospel of Thomas and all these other books that were ancient Gnostic texts that have been around for centuries, and from the Essenes, the Zadokites, the, you know, there's a lot of different religious groups back then, and a lot of people that think from the year zero in the Common Era to 325 or whatever, that those people were Christian. They weren't any form of Christianity that we would think of it today. You know, they were, you know, most people back then did not think Jesus was a historical character. In fact, in Gnosticism, that is strictly against what the Gnostics believe, that God would never manifest himself out of the divine light, because that would further pull people away from ever being able to come back to the divine light. You know, you don't reproduce, you don't grow outward, you bring things inward and try and narrow everything back into a single finite point to become one with God again. So the Catholic Church, starting with Hypatia, that's pretty much the kicking point of the for the next 1,200 years in the suppression of other cultures, and the Christian fanatics basically going around and slaughtering pretty much everybody that challenged them or that read books that had knowledge on herbs or drugs or anything for the next 1,200 years. And
what was the scope of the area that this...
Well, from the Middle East to all the way through Europe, and then beginning in the 1400s, 1500s, the suppression of the Native Americans with the Spanish Inquisitions in North America alone, the annihilation of 15 million Native Americans at least, which makes Hitler, you know, compared to U.S. history of genocide, it makes Hitler look sort of much less bad than what the U.S. has done in its history. And, you know, about 50% of all women were killed by either the Protestant or Catholic Church from probably roughly 1,000 or 1,200 up until the late or early 1700s, maybe 1729. I'd have to check my citations on that. But pretty much 50% of all women were killed during that time. And the women were the midwives, the healers. They had the knowledge of the herbs. The men were the hunters. And guess who were the gatherers? Typically the women. So it was typically the women were most often the ones with the connection to the plants and the knowledge of the plants and their effects and things like that. And so what the church did was, you know, if you were convicted of witchcraft, well, the church would get your property. So, of course, it was in the church's interest to convict you of witchcraft so they could take all your property. And during that time, the Catholic Church amassed the largest amount of property ever under its control. And, you know, so, you know, that's, in fact, that's actually why Soviet Russia was so against religion in the church, because the church had acquired so much, and here the churches were getting rich and the people were poor. You know, so let's take the land away from the churches and give it back to the people. But most people, when they study Soviet Russia, they only get the aspect, well, they didn't have freedom of religion. That's not really true. You know, and I lived in communist Yugoslavia under Milosevic for a number of years. And there, you know, basically the rule was if you're religious, you couldn't be in politics. So there's no, you know, if you're a Christian, sorry, there's the door. You're out of here. You know, they have real separation of church and state. You know, they don't have politicians that talk about separation of church and state and then go bomb Iraq in the name of God. You know, oh, I had some fanatical dream last night. God told me to go kill 1.6 million people. Let's go over there, you know. But actually, that's the history of the Bible. You know, Moses had his delusions that God came down and told him to kill 3,000 people because they were worshiping the bull. And the bull, by the way, is actually related to astrotheology and archaeoastronomy. The bull is actually Taurus, the constellation. They weren't worshiping an animal. They're not dumb animal worshippers. This was celestial knowledge. That's why the bull depicted in Egypt and ancient art, and including Christian art, always has the sun disk between its horns because it's the sign of Taurus.
We left off at you reading the work of John Allegro, and then where did you go from there, and how did you begin your research into the work that you've produced? I know people get interested in reading about these things, but how did you take the next step into actually doing this research and making an argument that is so...
Unorthodox. Well, it actually, going back to the situation in Yugoslavia, I was... Basically, what I would do is every time I went over there, I would take one suitcase of clothes and one suitcase of books. Because when you're not a citizen in a foreign country, there's not really much you can do for employment, and you've got a lot of free time on your hands. So
Why were you there? Why were you going there?
My ex-wife was Serb, and so we would live there part of the year and live here part of the year. And so I would take, literally every year we'd go over there and I would take one suitcase of books, and by the time I got back here, every single book in that case had been read. And so that, compiled with knowing a lot of authors and going back to Jack Hare, you know, Jack Hare is very close friends with George Clayton Johnson, who wrote Logan's Run and Ocean's 11 and some of the early Twilight Zones and some of the early Star Trek series and things like that. And I found myself surrounded by all of these different writers. And I, you know, well, I always wanted to be a writer. And I had been working on this theory for a book. I couldn't quite get it down. And you know, I just always knew that I wanted to write, but I couldn't see the direction that I wanted to write in. I didn't know what the topic was going to be for many years. And then sort of around 2002, 2003, I started getting the foundations of what I wanted to say, and I started testing my ideas in different areas to see if they would hold up. You know, if astrotheology could hold up in under different cultures with the same symbolism, and like the symbolism of the caduceus, for instance, does it hold up cross-culturally? And in fact, it does. You know, in Greek we had Hermes, Roman Mercury, Mayan Quetzalcoatl, and then even Egypt had, I forget the name for the symbol in Egypt, but sure enough, I could find these same symbols of basically what I consider drugs now. And the caduceus is the symbol that you pick up a pill bottle, and it's the staff entwined with, usually today, with two serpents. Originally it was one serpent and then the wings above. And so I basically just started bringing together this theory, and then that was when, through another researcher introduced me to Andy, you know, and he had called me in the middle of summer of 2003 when I was working on the book, and we started talking, and he seemed to have, at the time, a lot of the research that I hadn't covered yet, and I had a lot of the research that he hadn't covered yet, so we started putting our ideas together, and that's what became Astrotheology and Shamanism, the first book. You know, it was just one of those situations where, you know, I knew I wanted to write, I'd done all of this research, I knew what it was. So basically what I started doing at the time was, people had asked me what I do, I would say I'm a writer. You know, well, what do you write? Well, nothing yet. You know, well, pretty soon you better have something to show somebody. Well, what did you write? Well, here it is. You know, so that was sort of how things got started. And it was just, you know, one of those positive telling myself I'm going to do this and get on this and get it done. And So that was how it came to be.
Was there a moment where you really felt you were on to something with this theory?
Yeah, it was right around 2003 was when I started realizing that. Yeah, and that's what the subtitle of the first edition, which the second edition will change, but the subtitle of the first edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism is Unveiling the Law of Duality in Christianity and Other Religions. And I'm going to completely change that on the second edition. It'll be Christianity's Pagan Roots, a Revolutionary Reinterpretation of the Evidence. But with my studies, what I started realizing is that a common theme that you could find throughout the religions was as above, so below, as in the heavens, so on earth. And the animals in the sky and the animals on the ground and the red sun in the sky, well, then what would be the red sun on the ground? Everything was dualistic. And this is when this was a core piece of when I really began to understand a lot of the ancient mysteries was this law of duality. And that's what I coined it as. And I've seen other people probably before me. That was what I came up on my own. And it just dawned on me one day, sitting there doing all this research, and I had just read 20 or 30 books. And it just dawned on me one day that this is a law. It's not just an idea or a hypothesis. It's a law in understanding these ancient cultures and religions and how they thought. So then when I had that realization, then everything else started unfolding much more quickly. So it's, you know, that's really the core of what astrotheology and shamanism is. Astrotheology above, shamanism below. And it even has aspects and things that attribute to the human body. If you look at a lot of the ancient zodiac depictions, there are different zodiac signs are applied to the human body. And so there's actually different levels of this as above, so below, the macrocosm, the microcosm. And, you know, it's like you might have a hurricane as a macrocosm, and then a tornado would be a microcosm to a hurricane. And then, you know, your water swirling down the drain would be a microcosm to a tornado. So it can be on these many different levels of this theory. And so that's really how I came about, and that was the core thing that made me go, aha. You know, and I've kind of stepped away from that a little bit. We do bring it up in the first book, the fertility aspects. And, you know, it is my firm belief, and I think I have substantial evidence to back that belief, that nearly all religions are based on three primary things. And those things are, one, astrotheology, archaeoastronomy, the worship of the sun, the moon, the stars, the different constellations. You know, it's found in Freemasonry. It's found in just about everywhere you look. In the Bible, it says the stars in the heavens are made for signs. And then the next one going on would be entheogenic or psychedelic drugs. And could we apply this theme cross-culturally to different religions? Obviously, the sun worship and the lunar worship and things like that was pretty much a given. Not really difficult to prove that in ancient cultures. There's a lot of books written on that. But could we prove from Islamo-Judeo-Christianity to Mayan cultures, to Native Americans, to the Aborigines of Australia, to Asia, that they would use psychedelic plant substances in their religious ceremonies? And in fact, we can. And then, you know, once I started realizing that, you know, and that's what my newest book, The Holy Mushroom, that's coming out is the actual textual evidence. In astrotheology, in the first edition, it's pretty much based on iconographic evidence, but we didn't have a document that we could say, here's proof, argue this. So that my new book, The Holy Mushroom, is when we bring in the actual textual evidence from the ancient monasteries and from ancient interviews with Muhammad, if he can be considered a real person in history. Some argue either way if he's even real or not. And we found there's Professor John Rush is going to print with a book. I think it's supposed to go to print on September 1st, called Failed God. And he teaches up at Sierra College up in the Sacramento area. And he found a document called, in a book called The Mishkat. I don't remember the exact page and chapter. But it basically is talking about, or this interviewer asks Muhammad, what are mushrooms? And Muhammad tells him that that mushrooms are a type of manna that God sent to Moses so that man could see. And this has been mistranslated by many scholars in the past as, you know, some sort of cleanser to clean the eyes out, you know, like Visine or something, you know. It is, no, it's this wrong interpretation. And in my new book, there was a document that actually somebody had emailed to me sometime last summer, and it sat in my email for 7 months before I remembered it in this heated debate with this scholar, and he thought that there was no way that we could prove the use of mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, but we have this, we have this, we have this, we have this, and what about that text? And I just went, that text, you know? So I'm like running back to my computer, and there it is sitting on my computer. It's just been sitting there for 7 months, and I open it up and I start reading it. Published by Harvard University in 1994 by a Yale professor of Slavic languages. And it was a text that was discovered in the Ukraine, but it was actually written at the Zerpontmel Monastery on Mount Athos Peninsula in Greece, which I had visited many times in my trips through Europe. And I used to, as I was going through the Mount Athos Peninsula one day, I'm thinking, you know, there's got to be evidence here of these mushrooms in this religion. And I had just hiked a couple of weeks or a week before, I had just hiked Mount Olympus. And okay, so this is the place where the gods are and down there, and this is the right environment for these things to grow, and you know, it's got to be here somewhere. And sure enough, this text was from one of the monasteries that I had visited. Mm-hmm. And so the text...
How old is that text?
The text is from 1596, 1597. Mm-hmm. And it's discussing... Well, it's the Epistle of the Renegade Bishops, and it's discussing this this divide between the Orthodox Greek versus the Roman Latin priests and bishops. And the Latins were very money, monetary-driven, building their huge empire, acquiring all the money as Rome could. You know, and it's my personal belief that Rome never fell. It just morphed into the church that still controls a third of the world. And so from the divide between these bishops, you know, the Roman bishops had come to the Zerpontmel Monastery, and they had killed a bunch of the monks there and tried forcing everybody into believing the Latin way of Christianity. And the Orthodox monks believe more in a more modest level, that to be with God you had to be poor, you had to live in the worst conditions and things like that. You didn't clothe yourself in golden gowns and all of these things that that popes do today. And so this document talks about how when the Latin bishops came in and tried to take over, the holy mushroom grew out of the table and overtook the entire sanctuary and stopped the Latin bishops, and all of the infirm were healed by the mere taste of being able to touch this holy mushroom. So hence the name of my new book, The Holy Mushroom. And so that's some of the evidence that we have. And then what I also did in the new book was John Marco Allegro had received numerous unfounded attacks against his scholarship. And I was, back in 2006, I was writing an article on Wasson and Allegro, R. Gordon Wasson and John Allegro, called The Tree of Knowledge is Amanita. I believe that's the full title of it. And this is Michael Hoffman of egodeath.com. And as I was going through all of this research, I started realizing that there was a whole other area that nobody had seen before. And so I started going through all of Allegro's citations, and all of these scholars, including R. Gordon Wasson, said, oh, all of Allegro's citations are wrong. You know, and he would try and debunk Allegro by, Allegro took all of his work from me. And everybody just took Wasson's statements at face value. Nobody ever fact-checked him. You know, he was like the one that you didn't question. You know, he was the top of the field. And so I decided, well, you know, maybe I should start questioning Wasson's conclusions and start analyzing what was going on in Allegro's work. And then I found out that, in fact, Allegro did not base his research on Wasson, that he based it on Robert Graves, who was a friend of Wasson, but his primary foundation for his work was this professor from the London Botanical Museum that I mentioned earlier, Professor John Ramsbottom. So, you know, just one after the other, I started looking at all of Wasson's claims and all of these other claims against Allegro, and then I was the first person since 1970, with the publication of Allegro's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, to actually crack open the endnotes at the back of the book and check them. You know, and it dawned on me, how is it that a world full of scholars never went through the back of Allegro's book and said, okay, is this right? So I spent a lot of time over at Cal State Northridge Library and a lot of time on JSTOR going through all the academic documents and finding all these old articles and tracking down books and citation after citation, claim after claim after claim ended up being completely bogus. In fact, one of the biggest regurgitators of these errors, unfortunately, who, you know, was Jonathan Ott. And I'm a huge fan of Jonathan Ott's work. And in fact, I contacted him over the last few months and told him, look, you know, all of your points in your book are wrong. I spent 4 years trying to verify all of the claims that you made against Allegro's scholarship, and not one panned out, not one. And I said, would you care to write a retraction for your statements against Allegro? You know, in his book, he claims that Allegro contributed little or nothing to the field of ethnomycology and that Allegro was trying to profit off of Wasson's discoveries, but he doesn't give any evidence of this. It's just all claims. You know, and Allegro had a lot of debts that he was hard-pressed to pay off, and none of these claims panned out. And I had worked with John Allegro's daughter. I still work with her now. She's my editor. And worked with her for 4 years, and every single one of these claims, you know, we would go through, have her go through the Allegro archives, and, you know, the ones that we could verify, we verify. The ones we couldn't, you know, it's just, and, you know, there was just no substance to any of the attacks against his scholarship, against the work in the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And in fact, the errors that Wasson blamed on Allegro were mostly his own and his own personal friends. And Allegro cited Wasson only 4 times in his book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And technically, there was a 5th citation, which was actually through John Ramsbottom. What Wasson had done was sent a letter to John Ramsbottom in 1953 stating that in regards to a French fresco that depicts very clearly Adam and Eve on either side of a mushroom tree, he just dismissed it based on this scholar's interpretation, Erwin Panofsky, who said, oh, well, you know, it's this association with the mushroom is purely fortuitous and there's no chance it could be the mushroom. So Wasson takes this professor's word for it, who didn't study mycology or anything and had no idea of mushrooms, and he says, well, he writes Ramsbottom and says, well, we're going to reject the plain Corot fresco as being a mushroom, rightly or wrongly, out of hand, just like that. And without any evidence, without researching, without comparing other mushroom trees and things like that in Christianity. And so that was basically, you know, my main starting point was going in and looking at all of these different arguments and breaking them down and looking at what was said and who said what and where the argument went. And every instance, Allegro's reputation in the new book ended up being strengthened and Wasson's own reputation weakened. And we were able to show that the majority of modern scholars' biased opinions against Allegro's research was in fact started by Gordon Wasson. The, you know, just all paths lead to Wasson when it comes to the attacks on Allegro. And it was really disheartening because I was a big fan of Wasson's research too. And then, you know, my new book unfortunately puts a lot of Wasson's research under serious question, as well as his integrity. You know, like, he attacked Allegro for using one of his own friends as a citation, who was Andrea Puharich. And Andrea Puharich, he was a medical doctor who worked for the U.S. Army, and he also ran the chemical center at Edgewood, Maryland, collecting psychoactive substances for the MKUltra program and the CIA. And, you know, and Wasson says, well, you know, Allegro cites Puhrich, and Puhrich, but he doesn't state Puhrich's name. He simultaneously tries to protect Puhrich while disparaging Puhrich. And so he would say, well, Allegro used a man as a citation who was busy studying psychic, you know, or busy talking to dead Egyptian priests and things like that. Well, Wasson himself had worked with Puhrich. Wasson himself had agreed to do studies on telepathy and things like that with Puhrich in one of his trips to Mexico. And so complete hypocrisy on Wasson's part in his attacks against Allegro. And the fact that he intentionally called Puhrich a man instead of saying Dr. Puhrich in his letter, and most of the Wasson's attacks were published publicly in the Times Literary Supplement in England, and just filled with diatribe and double standards. And, you know, Wasson attacked Allegro for publishing in a newspaper, the Sunday Mirror. Wasson got the name wrong and called it the News of the World or something, which was like one of our, you know, that you buy at one of those newspapers that you buy at the
Inquirer
and stuff like that. But Wasson himself had gone public in the 1950s in Life magazine, and I think it was 1957, I believe. And Wasson had gone public in a non-academic mainstream newspaper magazine-like publication, but he just had a hard time that Allegro did the same thing. So he attacked Allegro for doing the same thing that he did to get his own research out to the public. And he says, well, you know, that Sunday Mirror is just not up to the academic journal level that Allegro normally publishes with. Well, Allegro's book was 400 or 500 pages, and no academic journal is going to take a 500-page thesis, and it had to be published as a whole. You know, you couldn't break it down because then it would lose the meat and the core of what Allegro was trying to get at. So, you know, and Wasson called Allegro, and a lot of his attacks, called Allegro an Italian Jew, and Allegro was half French and half English, you know, and I think that he used the Jewish line because, oh, well, he's Jewish, so of course he would be attacking Christianity. You know, and he would use things, tactics like these that just one after the other ended up being completely baseless slander and diatribe against Allegro. And the real thing that Wasson was out to do was protect his own theory that he published in his book Soma in 1968, The Divine Mushroom of Immortality. And in that book, Wasson argued that the use of mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity was limited to 1000 BCE. And Allegro brought that all the way up to 1300 with the plain coral fresco. And so if Allegro was right, then it automatically made a big chunk of Wasson's own research wrong. And so Wasson's attack on Allegro was two-part. One, to save his own ridiculous theory, and the other was to use the publication of Allegro's book to advertise his own. And Wasson's books are actually the most expensive books ever published by a living author. And today, like, a copy of Wasson's Mushrooms, Russia, and History runs anywhere between $2,000 to $8,000. And for a first edition copy of his book Soma, it's up there, you know. And as the economy slumps, I've been noticing the prices of these books coming down. But you know, 2-3 years ago, you couldn't even get a copy of those books, you know, of a first edition for under, you know, several thousand dollars. And so, you know, that was my intention of the new book, is go through and look at all the diatribe and lay out each and every reference point by point. Okay, Wasson said this, this scholar says that. Here's what Allegro said in the book. Here's what the footnote says. Here's the original citation. Mm-hmm. Next, you know, Allegro, footnote, citation. Allegro, footnote, citation. And one after the other, all of these arguments against him just started falling apart. Just one, you know, literally, none of them had any sustenance.
I'm here speaking with author Jan Ervin, and he's written a book and produced a DVD called Astrotheology and Shamanism, and your DVD is called The Pharmacratic Inquisition. So we left off with how you got into the research, what motivated you, and the current state of what you're looking at, which you will be releasing as The Holy Mushroom, and that is...
The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity.
And also you take up, in that book, do you take up what you were just talking about the arguments... Debunking
Allegro.
Yeah,
that's the
that's in the same book.
The subtitle is mouthful. Let's see if I can remember it off the top of my head. A critical reevaluation of the schism between R. Gordon Wasson and Gianmarco Allegro over the theory on the origins of religion presented in the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. That's the full subtitle.
Okay, so
it's,
you're
it's the new book is heavily academic. It's for the doubting Thomases, especially the professors, the archaeologists and classics professors and things out there who have dismissed Allegro's research out of hand, and this is going to be a big wake-up call for them. You know, I wrote it specifically for the academic audience, but I hope that I don't lose the mainstream by going after the academic audience on this one. Allegro was he was a pioneer, no doubt, and with any pioneer who begins a field of research, there are errors. I look at Allegro's research as about 70% correct. The overall majority of his conclusions and assumptions are correct. In fact, Professor Karl Rux, the professor of the Greek Classics Department at Boston University, has recently come out endorsing my book, and... he has agreed to go public that Allegro was correct, and you know, so this is a big step. And the Professor Rush up in Northern California has also decided to go public in his new book, False God, that Allegro was correct. That's the one that's published this coming September 1st. There are a number of scholars that are starting to sway, but you know, with especially with Professor Ruck at Boston U, he has found many correlations that he's found correct in Allegro's work, and just the analogies that Allegro has come up with. And Professor Ruck is certain that far more than I published in my book of Allegro's findings are correct. And Ruck is going to be publishing a book in 2009 called Entheogens and Christianity. It's basically, he's going to put his neck out on the line that Allegro was correct. And there seems to be a gathering pool of professors and academics that are ready to stand up and say that Allegro was more right than wrong. You know, typically speaking, you never really find any scholar who's more than about 90 to 95% correct. There's always some margin of error there. And, you know, and typically anything 70% or above is relatively good, you know, whether or not they have minor errors. So, but being that Allegro was entering into a field that didn't exist before, Gordon Wasson flat out refused that entheogens had anything to do with Christianity. You know, and that part of Jonathan Ott's argument against Allegro was, well, how come Wasson never consult, or how come Allegro never consulted Wasson on this stuff? Well, because Wasson states flat out in his books that there's no way that this stuff has any tie to Christianity. So Allegro is saying, well, based on Wasson's own words, rightly or wrongly, we're going to reject the plain chorale fresco. Allegro looks at that and is like, well, look at this wishy-washy waffling. What kind of academic analysis is rightly or wrongly we're going to reject this, you know? So so you know, Allegro is like, well, we're gonna look at it as wrongly and start looking into Judeo-Christianity and start bringing it up to the present, which, like, you know, Dr. Dan Merker from Syracuse Theological Seminary came out The Mystery of Manna, arguing that manna was ergot. Unfortunately, he forgets in his own book that he's arguing that ergot is a substitute for the manna of the wilderness years. And when you look up the word wilderness in ancient Hebrew, like in a Strong's Concordance, it says wilderness is the word midbar in Hebrew, which means a cow pasture. So where does that take us? Back to psilocybe cubensis mushrooms. So, you know, the biggest chance is that there, and we talk about this in astrotheology and shamanism, that the manna of the wilderness was the psilocybe mushrooms that they were, you know, they're following their cattle around, and ready mushrooms. And then we argue that the hidden manna of revelation was the Amanita muscaria, the red and white mushroom that grows under the trees and the shrubbery, therefore being hidden.
This is KUCR Radio, 88.3 FM in Riverside, and this is Walter of the Woods. This is a special edition of Psyched Electronics. So we're going to be speaking with a special guest that we have brought into the KUCR studios, and that would be Jan Irvin. You have a couple of books, or a few books, and also a DVD.
Well, I have one book in print now, and another one that's due out in the next couple of months.
So what you talk about in this research has to do with astrotheology and shamanism, and also what you call the Pharmacratic Inquisition. Could you talk about, earlier on, you mentioned about the historical figure of Jesus.
Ahistorical. There's no history of it. There's just no evidence to back it up. And in fact, you know, every couple of years, the Christians come out with this new discovery that's the next thing that proved Jesus existed. And usually within a few months to a year, it's been debunked. And then they have to go find the next thing. And they've been trying to prove for almost 2,000 years, they've been trying to find that one piece of evidence that proves that it's real. And as far as you go back, reading the ancient texts, and, you know, the arguments haven't changed. The Christians were made fun of for the first 200 or 300 years, from 0 to 200 or 300, for even suggesting that Jesus was a real character, because everybody else understood it as mythology. And so the Christians were scoffed at because they took these myths as historical.
In the research that you've done, what does the figure of Jesus represent?
Well, that's kind of a deep, loaded question that might sound a little psychotic without going into a lot of background on it. But first and foremost, I think that on the macrocosm, as above, Jesus represents the sun. And I'll use this as a chance to segue into precession of the equinoxes for a moment, and the cycle of the sun. On December 25th, the sun is born again. The sun in the sky is born again and starts heading north. From the summer solstice, typically around June 21st, until the winter solstice, typically December 21st, 22nd, the sun is falling to the south each day. It rises a little bit closer to the south each day, and you'll notice that the shadows in your house change, and as the sun falls during the fall to the south, that's why it's called the fall. The sun is falling to the south, and the days become shorter, and the weather gets cooler, and when the sun reaches December 21st, or the winter solstice, the word solstice means sun stands still. And the sun doesn't immediately bounce right back and start heading north again on December 21st. What it does is it's in a tomb for 3 days, where it appears to be dead for 3 days. And then after 3 days, on December 25th, the sun starts heading north again. Christmas is actually the real New Year's Day. And during the ancient Yuletide celebrations, they would burn a log that would keep lit, you know, and in certain parts of the earth, like above the 66.5 degree latitude line, it's pretty much dark for 3 days. You know, if you're living in northern Sweden or Norway, it's dark. And so the first aspect of the Jesus myth is that he is based on sun worship. And there's other aspects in this. I mentioned the precession of the equinoxes. That's what's known as the great year. Actually, the precession is the proper term, but it's also called the great year. A couple other names out there for it. But the precession of the equinoxes in this great year lasts 25,800 years, and the precession is broken down, instead of into lunar months or moonths, we have ages. You know, and I mentioned earlier the worship of Taurus the bull, and each age or each precessional month is 2,150 years. And it's called a precession because it goes backward through the zodiac instead of the normal progression like the monthly zodiac cycles going through a regular calendar year. And what happens is when we look to the east on the spring equinox or vernal equinox, the symbol behind the rising sun is the symbol of that particular symbol of the zodiac for 2,150 years. And critical evidence shows that the precession was really discovered in about 127 BCE. And immediately following that, there is strong evidence to suggest that its knowledge was very rapidly adapted into religion.
This knowledge was coming out of what group of people?
The Hipparchus, I forget the guy's name exactly, is the original discoverer of it. You know, so we go through these precessional ages, and I mentioned, like I said, the Taurus, the bull. Next after that is Aries, and Aries is the symbol of the ram. And the ram has the horns and all of that. Well, Judaism is the religion of the ram, the religion of the age of Aries. And Moses, instead of killing his son, kills the ram as symbolic. And, the timelines aren't perfect because these are things that were discovered after or written into the religions after a lot of them had been created. Like the early stages of Judaism had already been created at that point, so they went back and they would edit these things in as they would gain astronomical knowledge. Following Aries in the precession of equinoxes, we have Pisces, and Pisces is the symbol of two fish. Jesus is the fisher of men. He fed the masses with two fish. And going back to Moses, Moses is very often, even in the Vatican, Moses is depicted with horns on his head like Aries. So in the Bible, Jesus says, where are we to go? When Jesus is getting ready to be taken off to be crucified, they say, where do we go? And Jesus tells him, follow the man into the house. I think it's Luke. Follow the man into the house who bears the pitcher of water. And the zodiac sign, we go the ram, the fish, and then we go to Aquarius, which is the man bearing the pitcher of water, which is an unusual statement in itself. Well, if Jesus is walking into a city and he sees a man bearing a pitcher of water today, we think, well, what significance does that have? You see guys carrying water bottles all over the place. Well, back then, it was the woman's job to carry the water, so a man bearing a pitcher of water would be a significant symbol. And so that's how Jesus has these ties to both the precession and the sun. Next part of the foundations of religion and Judeo-Christianity and the ahistoricity of the Jesus myth, on the microcosm, the Jesus myth has very strong ties to the Amanita muscaria mushroom as well as other entheogenic substances, as I sort of mentioned with a lot of ideas through the talk tonight. And John Allegro is a great one to look at the ties between the mushroom and Jesus, as well as our book Astrotheology and Shamanism, and then in my newest book, The Holy Mushroom, I found, actually thanks to Professor Carl Ruck, I found he provided me an image that somebody sent to him from France that very clearly depicts the child Jesus as a mushroom. So we not only have the idea that Allegro proposed through linguistics that Jesus was the mushroom, but now we're starting to be able to triangulate in on that with iconography as well.
So Jan, can you tell me a little bit about what you say the relationship between the forbidden apple and the mushroom is?
Well, the forbidden apple or the forbidden fruit... Apples are red, and it's kind of funny that we consider apples, the apple is the forbidden fruit, or is depicted in artwork as the forbidden fruit, and then we tell kids that an apple a day will keep the doctor away, which is kind of a conundrum. But the apple is red in color, and when you take a bite out of it, it's white inside, and it grows on a tree. The Amanita muscaria mushrooms are red, and when you take a bite out of it, they're white inside. And in fact, in the first book, I look at the word pineapple as misapplied. I think originally the pineapples were meant as the Amanita muscaria mushrooms and had nothing to do with the Hawaiian pineapples that we think of today. Oxford argues that it was originally a pine nut or a pine seed that was argued as a pine apple, but that just doesn't make sense. You know, why would a pine seed be argued as a pine apple? The mushrooms, especially the Amanita species, are all grown in a symbiotic relationship with trees. Pine trees, the Amanita muscaria likes pine, fir, birch. Sometimes they can be found under oak trees. The Amanita pantherina, which is a blackish or brownish color mushroom, also with spots, typically associates itself with oak trees. Abraham has his oracle under the oak. If we look at Christmas, we bring the tree into the house. We put brightly colored packages underneath the Christmas tree. And all of these trees, the trees are the key to the ancient mysteries, really. But these mushrooms grow in symbiotic relationship with the trees, and all of the trees that these mushrooms grow with just happen to be, looking at ancient cultures in a historical perspective, all of the trees that Amanitas grow under happen to be sacred. And that includes the fir and the pine and the birch and, you know, and witchcraft and all these ancient pagan cultures. And the trees are sacred. In fact, the word druid means oak. You know, so the druids were oak tree worshippers. Christians bring the Christmas tree into the house, and it's very clearly an ancient pagan ritual that had to do with the Yuletide celebrations in winter. And the tree was considered sacred because it could last throughout the winter without dying. And not only that, but these huge conifer trees are very phallic in their appearance and had associations to fertility worship and things like that tied with it. So it's the symbiotic relationship between the mushroom and the tree, and then using the apple as the metaphor for the story that's presented to the public to keep it sort of secret. And once you figure out, like I can't remember what passage in the Bible. Look in the forest for the apple amongst the trees is something to that effect. You know, when we start understanding these metaphors and we understand what tree it was and what we're looking for, suddenly if you're in a forest looking for an apple, you know, you would usually look for an apple probably with an apple orchard, and I don't think that usually apple trees survive in a conifer-type forest. And so when we start thinking about things in that way, then we can start saying, hey, well, maybe this red thing that looks like a round red apple on the ground over underneath this pine tree is the mushroom. You know, it's just a symbolic relationship between the two.
Mm-hmm. Was that something original that you had found, or did you also find other people that also found
these
types
of... Gordon Wasson first talked about it. There's been a lot of people that have talked about the association with that. That's certainly not my original discovery. And then the third thing is religion, or relation to sex. The seed is obviously the generative principle in life. You know, what creates all life. So the seed was worshipped. The male and female generative powers were worshipped. And Mary is the suppressed ancient symbol of the female deity, the female goddess, the Pistis Sophia, what brings us into existence, and often depicted in Christianity as the Vesica Piscis, the Vesica Pisces, and that is the portal into this world. And in these art depictions, and including the Lady of Guadalupe, Mary is standing in the Vesica because that's where life comes from, out of the female. So that gives you, a threefold, a triangular foundation on what I base my research on, and the primary positions that religions in general are based upon: fertility, drugs, and star and sun worship. And these were all necessary things that you had to know in these ancient cultures that our society just suppresses. And in fact, my third book is going to be on the history of fertility cults and their relation to the entheogenic drugs. I haven't picked out a solid title yet, but probably Sex and Drugs in the History of Religion, or Sex and Psychedelics in Christianity, or something like that.
Has anybody made the statement that possibly the Amanita mushroom was the voice of Jesus,
I think, you know, as far as Moses and the voice of God coming down on him with the burning bush, Abraham and the oracle under the oak, Paul's visions, you know, I think they're all drug related.
So what's,
you know, either they're either drug related or we're dealing with what we would today call schizophrenic.
If you are receiving this knowledge and having this mystical experience that is written about in the Bible and all mythologies, what is this voice? Where is this source of knowledge?
Research probably couldn't tell you anything about it. We quote-unquote hypothesize many ideas about this in the book. There's a book called The Holographic Universe by Michael Talbot. And, you know, he argues that if you take the image of a dog and you break it into a million pieces, you have a million dogs. You know, it doesn't really lose its holistic thing. And, you know, what if these mushrooms and mushrooms, fungi in general, are some of the oldest substances on Earth? What if they're really the Gaia, the Mother Goddess's history, you know, the history of the planet? And when we consume these things, we can see and hear and learn this ancient history. That's, you know, that's obviously pure speculation on my part, but you know, and I've tried to work with a couple of different models to pinpoint down on that. But you know, there are many, many, many people who do these things do hear voices of the plants. And you know, if you go down to the Amazon jungle and you ask a lot of the shamans how they learned about a certain thing, they'll tell you, well, the plants told me, you know. And everything is alive, you know, and it's not a voice like you normally hear. It's more like a sight, voice, vision, everything sort of mixed together and none of that at the same time. It's more like just a knowing. It's like you suddenly have a, you know, this object or this plant can do this, this, and that, you know, and then you take it home and you try it, and whoa, it worked, you know. And, you know, I've definitely experienced some things like that myself. And one of the things that has been researched heavily with entheogens is telepathy. And Dr. Jeremy Narby in The Cosmic Serpent, he argues that that possibly it's the DNA between the plants and human consciousness, that, you know, the DNA emits a very slight radio frequency, and that possibly entheogens allow us to pick up on this radio frequency from this frequency from Mother Nature. So
does this knowledge help
entheogens? I think first and foremost, they give us an awareness that we didn't have before. I think that they speed up the brain and the brain's ability to process thoughts and the level of processing that can be done, the depth of understanding that can be gained, seeing things from alternative perspectives. I think probably half of the Silicon Valley is on some form of psychedelic drug as they develop computer systems and things like that. In fact, many have reported trying to figure out a problem on a microprocessor and why it won't function properly, and then they take LSD and they'll act as an atom going through the conductors of a chip and figure out what the problem is. You can literally walk in somebody else's shoes on these substances. You can become that person and understand them for who they are and why they are that way. And but the awareness that we are all connected to the One. You know, if God is omnipresent, then we're all God. And, you know, the Bible says your body is the temple of God, yet the churches don't want you to look within yourself to find God, which seems like a conundrum to me. And if God is really omnipresent, or the goddess, or Gaia, or whatever you want to call it, or her, or whatever, it seems to me most reasonable to look inward to find these things, or to discover what we are as humans. And when we discover when we have the deep experience. And just taking these substances doesn't necessarily mean that you'll have a deep, full-blown experience. You know, before I figured out the deeper levels of the experience in high school and early college, I had taken psychedelic drugs probably 200 times in party and, you know, friend situations. And until I sat down in a dark room and tried it in a much different way, it wasn't until then that I ever had a full-blown experience, and it was like I had never even done them before up until that point. So they help us see ourselves as ourselves. They help us peel away the dogma and the conditioning of society, and they help us realize that we're all here on this planet trying to work our way through on the same struggles and things like that, and that we don't need to follow some jealous god to discover what we are as human beings. And in fact, the entheogens would show us that is what is keeping us from ever having peace on this planet. You know, and until everybody has their own wake up, their own epiphany, their own self-discovery, we're going to continue on this self-destructive path. So psychologists have shown since the 1950s and 60s that they've had incredible success using entheogenic substances with people with mental health problems. And I've seen it time and time again in people that I've experienced these things with, and people who have had problems with family and childhood and things like that, they're able to go in and realize, you know, why am I acting this way? And then they'll go in and pull this information out. And, you know, you don't have to go to a psychiatrist or a priest to find this stuff out.
Can you talk about healing in relationship to how a shaman would use psychedelics in their own self-healing and then the healing of others?
Well, that's another very touchy, sticky area in and of itself. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, the definition of shamanism, and I probably should have, this is a good time to segue into that because I should have covered this earlier. Shamanism isn't just about healing. It's not just about cleansing out the self. Shamanism is just as much about warfare and retributive killing as it is about healing. And, you know, the professor Neil Whitehead from University of Wisconsin-Madison has done a lot of pioneering research into dark shamanism and the Kanema of Guyana, South America. He was actually the victim of a dark shaman attack down there, and very lucky to have survived it. Shamanism, in the traditional sense, when the shaman, you know, when things were much less scientifically based and much more superstition, the shaman, if somebody in the tribe was sick, it was the goal of the shaman to figure out who was the sorcerer that cast the spell on that person, and then go out and make a retributive killing against that person. So it takes the New Age neo-shamanism to a whole new level.
These shamans tap into a source of knowledge that isn't necessarily going to guide them to a good...
beautiful, pretty lights and colors and, you know, glory days. And no, it's not. You know, it's still very reality-based. And, you know, obviously there are pools of knowledge that the shaman can pull from, and some of the entheogens are very much that way, but at the same time, others are not, like I mentioned the berserkers earlier with the Amanita muscaria. And tobacco is one of the substances that is traditionally used by the dark shaman, but not the tobacco we have today. It's tobacco Nicotiana rustica, which is far more powerful. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were to smoke a few cigarettes of that, you would probably be on a full-blown experience. Nicotine in and of itself is a very powerful psychedelic substance. The healing aspects, obviously there is a lot of healing that goes on with it, you know, but most people don't realize that the healing aspects are so much centered around our neocentric philosophies of shamanism today, which, You know, I mentioned Alice Kehoe in her book Shamanism earlier, and that's partly why she argues so much against the use of shamanism globally, but I haven't found a better word to use yet, so I concur with her findings, but I don't agree with her conclusion that we should abandon the word. You know, it's a very useful word, but the definition of shamanism is just so vast, and it's such a generic term.
Could you just briefly talk about the distinction in our culture of the function of a priest versus the function of a shaman in bringing people into the ecstatic experience?
Well, I think traditionally shamans probably had a lot more to do, as with the Amazon shamans today, they have a lot more to do with the community as a whole, and you know, and typically initiations into adulthood and things like that would require the use of entheogenic substances, and in a lot of these cultures you weren't an adult until you had your first full-blown trip, and probably in Africa with the use of iboga, it was a prime example. There was a TV show recently, I can't remember, it may have been Taboo, or I forget, the host name was Bruce, and he would, Going Tribal, I think was the name of the show. And he went down into Africa and did iboga with a tribe down there, and they gave him the full-blown experience, and the whole community, the entire tribe, was involved in making sure that his full-blown experience happened so that he could reach adulthood. You know, because in their society, even though he was 30 or 40 years old, in their society, he wasn't an adult. He didn't get it yet. And so he walked out of there just going, I'm never going to forget these people. This was huge. You know, he's like walking out of the village on his last day, just going, he was just overwhelmed and in tears, you know, that this tribe had dedicated so much to his mental health and his having this experience. So going back to the priest, you know, you go into a little booth and you have confession, and then the priest is really, he's intercepting your own ability to connect with the divine yourself. It's like, it's in his best interest to keep his job. And he's not really providing anything of spiritual significance. I mean, you walk out and you think, woohoo, I feel holy, I went to church on Sunday and this and that. But it's, you know, and then Monday you go back to work and you screw your employees over and you do the things that these people do. And then the next weekend they go and they do it over again. Entheogens are also known as teacher plants, and they're said to teach the proper way to live. You know, so, you know, instead of going to church every Sunday and forgive your sins so that you can go back on Monday and Tuesday and do them all over again, that just doesn't fly in the shaman world. You know, and the entheogens are, in my own personal experience and the experiences of many others I've known, the entheogens seem to be very against that type of behavior. I mean, if you have those things going on in your life, the karma in a entheogenic experience, when it starts pulling up all these suppressed subconscious thoughts, they tear you up, and they just, you know, you'll have a miserable time for 4 or 5 hours. And you'll probably want to run from yourself and never want to do them again. That makes everybody else think, huh, why was he so afraid of himself that he doesn't want to look at himself? You know, going back to what I had mentioned earlier. So it's it's about growth. I mean, your typical Christian isn't interested in discovering new things and thinking outside the box. They're very comfortable in their little square box and believing what they've been told to believe, not thinking on their own and discovering on their own and realizing that everybody, including the evil Muslims on the other side of the world, are just like them. And, you know, so I think that's really the difference.
I'm also here with colleague Mylan Pham.
Jan, can you explain a little bit about how the dollar sign is connected to the caduceus?
The caduceus, there's two forms of the caduceus. You basically have the caduceus of the rod with a single serpent, also known as Aaron's rod or the staff of Asclepius. And that was traditionally the one that was used in medicine and a symbol of healing. The staff of Asclepius is deeply embedded in healing. And then, you know, Moses puts the serpent up on the pole, and and the people are healed if they just remember the pole or look at the pole with the serpent hanging on it. And ironically, the pole that's typically depicted in artwork looks exactly like a cross with a snake hanging on it, which we argue in the book that is synonymous with Jesus hanging on the cross. Jesus the healer, the snake the healer. And then the other caduceus, which is kind of the more common one today. And today the staff of Asclepius or Aaron's rod is typically used for like EMTs and ambulances and chiropractors and professions that don't dispense drugs, whereas the caduceus with the two serpents with the wings on top has been more synonymous with, maybe this is why it's synonymous with drugs and healing today, is because we've moved away from the holistic, natural approach to healing. And the two serpents winged caduceus is actually the symbol of pirates and merchants and thieves and things like that, you know, and probably why most new Las Vegas casinos put them over or near their front doors. But it's an ironic symbol to have also associated with medicine. And the serpent, both single and, or the caduceus, both single and dual serpent, appears to have developed into our monetary system. The word mercury, etymologically speaking, is where we derive the word merchant from, and merchandise. And originally, the merchandise was herbs and spices and drugs, and those were very commonly traded products for thousands of years. You know, you basically had bland food, and when somebody had spices, woohoo! You know, it was a rare thing, and spices were very expensive up until the last 100-150 years. So the dollar sign itself is the symbol of the caduceus. It is the symbol of both the symbol of healing and the symbol of the merchants and the thieves and the pirates and all of that. So it's kind of got an interesting history and twist to it, you know, and I'm not the first one who's presented that idea. Since I came up with the idea and published it, I think I've found three or four other books that had already published the exact same thing. I'm like, wait. Well, at least we're all on the same page. But, you know, Mercury, the winged caduceus of Mercury and Hermes, Mercury was the messenger of the gods, and he was the one that, you know, ran between the gods to deliver them the messages to each other. And interestingly, in relation with that to entheogenic drugs, the word angel is also a messenger and a vessel, depending on which route you take for it. And so Hermes and Mercury and the caduceus have direct associations to the angels and the messengers of the gods. And if we look at most depictions of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, they're typically standing on either side of a tree or a mushroom that depicts a serpent climbing the tree, which is the symbol of the caduceus, the symbol of drugs, symbol of healing, of the pharmacopoeia, however you want to pronounce it. And so the symbol, the caduceus, has ties to Jesus, has ties to the drugs that Adam and Eve used to gain enlightenment or be cast out of the garden, which is really a backward term. You know, if you read the older texts, it wasn't quite that way. In fact, in the Gnostic text on the origins of the world, on the origin of the world by, I think, Robbins or Robinson, printed in the Nag Hammadi, Adam was born from Eve, not the other way around, and the Lord in the Bible was the landlords in the Nag Hammadi. And when Pista Sophia discovered what the landlords were doing to Adam and Eve, it was the landlords who were cast out of Eden, not Adam and Eve. So and the biblical story has been completely flip-flopped. It's completely the opposite of what the traditional stories were. And I think that this, you know, all has to do with knowledge and with the entheogens. And they believed, and a lot of people still do, and there seems to be a lot of evidence to suggest that the entheogens themselves have somehow catapulted us into what we are today. Mm-hmm. Going back to Peter Webster, he's got research coming out that suggests that it's the psychedelic drug's ability to cause increased awareness instantly that has catapulted us above all of the other species.
There has been research done in the last couple of decades.
With Dr. Strassman, he is associate professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico, and he started back probably about, I think it was probably about 1990, maybe even earlier than that, to acquire the permits to do his first study on DMT or dimethyltryptamine. Since then, there's been a numerous amount of studies that have come out. Johns Hopkins University has just published a couple of studies on the effects of mushrooms on the religious experience. Professor, I think it's Stanislav Grof, has published several books on psychedelics and psychiatry, and basically argues that, you know, if you're not using psychedelic drugs to study psychiatry, it's like studying astronomy without a telescope. And what we know, and what Strassman is currently doing new research on to see if he can find out more information, is the argument is that DMT may be potentially created in the pineal gland. And the pineal gland is an actual third eye. If you look at a lizard on the top of the lizard's head, you can actually see the pineal gland right on the top of the skull. And so, you know, in mammals, it goes further down into the brain, but it's actually the third eye, and it's represented in Hinduism and Buddhism with the dot on the forehead. And you know, it's the eye of vision, and, you know, the Bible talks about that sort of stuff as well. But what we do know and what is proven is that DMT is a natural neurotransmitter, and that it's found in all mammal brains, probably most animal brains, period. It's also found in the majority of plant life. And what Strassman argues is that possibly DMT is like the seat of the soul, what sort of connects reality. And right now, every single person on this planet has DMT flowing through their brains. And it's one of the most powerful psychedelic substances on Earth. And when you take this substance, it immediately, this reality disappears, and you immediately find yourself in another dimension that's just as real as this one. In fact, most people after doing things like DMT argue that the other reality is more real than this one is, not the other way around. Whereas historically people have tried to argue these things as hallucinations, but there's just no evidence for that, and that's why they've since moved on to using the term entheogen. DMT, the psilocybin studies done by Johns Hopkins University and things like that, there's a lot of new research. Another group, MAPS, which is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, they have been promoting psychedelic research all over the world, and they've really been one of the largest players in getting academia to start taking up the research again. Basically, psychedelics weren't studied for about 20 to 25 years, primarily because of Timothy Leary and the acid 60s. And Timothy Leary, even though he was a Harvard professor, really gave acid a bad name. And the problem with acid and a lot of these other entheogenic substances, acid or LSD as many people know it, is that they, as a famous quote by Leary that he probably doesn't even remember or didn't remember saying, was that LSD has the ability to cause psychosis in people who have never taken it. And that's basically what that means, is that, you know, people are so freaked out by the idea of these substances that they go into a psychotic state without ever even taking them, just in their reaction about them, because they're so ill-informed and the substances are so misunderstood, even though all of them, including LSD, all have ancient ties to religion. And LSD in its natural form comes in ergot and in morning glory seeds. Morning glory seeds were worshipped by the Maya and the Olmec and the Inca and used as religious sacraments. And ergot has been argued by Wasson and Professor Ruck at Boston University and a couple of other researchers to be ergot. And recently Peter Webster in 2004 put out a video, Psychedelics in Eden, I believe is the name of the video, where he argues with new research, being an expert in that specific area with ergot and LSD, he shows that Wasson and Ruck's earlier interpretation wasn't exactly spot on, and a lot of people tried to dismiss, like there's this guy, Dr. Andy Letcher, who wrote a book called Shroom that makes all of these ridiculous, shallow arguments against religion's foundation and psychedelic drugs, and he really avoids most of the research to make his case. But one of the things he did was he used Wasson and Ruck's book, The Secrets of Ulysses, as one of his cornerstones of debunking the history of psychedelics and religion. But he didn't even know that 3 years before he even wrote the book, an entirely new level of research had come out, totally substantiating on it. That, you know, he didn't even acknowledge that research existed, and of course didn't address it in any form. And so, you know, his book is found in just about every major bookstore, and it's unfortunately I rank it as at best diatribe, you know. So that covers a lot of the newer research from the chemical psychological standpoint, all the way up to the latest archaeological evidence as far as the Lysinian mysteries and researchers like Dr. Letcher.
Why is there a stigma about inebriation?
That's a very good question. You know, and the interesting thing is, you know, when we look at history, where did psychedelic or psychoactive substances go from being one of the most revered substances in a culture to being one of the most taboo? And you know, people in this society, it's one of our paramount taboos is exploring our own minds, because I think possibly because people are so ingrained in religious dogma that, you know, if they question their religious beliefs, God will, you know, hear them and cast doubt on them, and they'll be cast out of heaven into Dante's hell or something like that for, you know, for even the mere question of looking at these things. But people are so wrapped up in the fear of the experience, the fear of themselves. And that's probably the main thing, is people are so afraid of themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've told very hardcore Christians that, you know, just, you know, no, and they just deny it. No, and I'm like, well, you know, what if you had to start accepting responsibility for your own actions? No, I don't want to, yeah, you know, they just get totally freaked out. You know, it's like, well, then I would be responsible for myself and my own actions and how I treat people. And you know, it's contradictory to everything that's in the Bible, because we read in the Bible about the Eucharist, and Jesus says, drink my blood, eat my flesh. So is Christianity, you know, that leaves us with quite the paradox, doesn't it? Is Christianity based on cannibalism? Well, let's see, when I eat flesh, you know, eating human flesh, I just don't think would have any enlightening aspects to it. And of course, people can argue, well, Jesus was the man in the blood. Well, you know, if we look at it in an ahistorical manner, then that paradox suddenly becomes rather unpleasant. Okay, so it's Christianity is based on cannibalism, or might it be based on the same things that so many of the other religions are based on, psychoactive substances? And, you know, the Maya have their flesh of God, and it's called Teonanacatl. You know, and as you eat the flesh of God, Christianity has their flesh of God. You know, if we look at the newer research coming out and look at the textual evidence of what manna was and start thinking about Jesus in an ahistorical fashion, then it really doesn't seem that unreasonable to consider the blood and the blood and the flesh as being entheogens rather than some twisted cannibalistic religious dogma that's managed to last for 2,000 years. The Native American churches that practices peyote, I think there's two or three of the churches that are allowed to use the sacrament legally. Ayahuasca is used by the Santa Daime, and there's one other church that's allowed to use it legally in the U.S. I think there's a couple of the churches in Los Angeles, but they're spread out as new proof comes to print, including my new book, The Holy Mushroom, that comes to print that proves the historical use of these things in Judeo-Christianity and Islam as well. Prior to these texts coming out, we really didn't have a historical basis to use as proof that these things had religious use. And the thing with the use of peyote is they really try and limit the use of peyote to Native Americans. You know, they don't really like white guys going and joining the Native American church, even though we're supposed to have freedom of religion and all of this stuff. But hopefully that's going to change. And since we can now prove that that both the Amanitas and psilocybe varieties of mushrooms are, that Christianity is intrinsically based on them, I think that will hopefully begin to change soon. I think that is one of the biggest crimes against humanity today is outlawing the sacred plants, whether it be cannabis or mushrooms or peyote. It's one of the biggest stains on humankind's history that there could be. With that said, and with the throwing out the First Amendment freedom of religion clause, whatever that means,
can you talk a little bit about how in Catholicism, where you take the communion, how that became a piece of bread and wine, and how that tradition was lost?
Well, as far as Judeo-Christianity, I think, you know, like I mentioned earlier, the midbar for the man of the wilderness was most likely psilocybe, and then, as Dan Merker has argued, a lot of it was ergot. And speaking of Dan Merker, he argues in his book, The Mystery of Manna, that basically as cultures go from being tribal shamanic to king-priest class, where in the shamanic culture, and they're often more matrilineal than patriarchal, obviously in a matrilineal culture, everything goes to the community as a whole to help sustain the culture. But when culture starts switching over to a patriarchy-type system, then everything starts falling under ownership and control and manipulation and things like that. And you know, most likely the mushroom became the cracker, became the bread, the blood became the wine, which the blood was most likely originally an extract of the Amanita muscaria, as Don Teeter has argued in a book called The Sacred Secret, that he's been able to actually recreate. He does this process where he leaves the mushroom sitting in water, whatever, for several weeks, and it starts to grow again in its own stuff. I haven't read Teeter's book in a few years, so it's not that fresh off the top of my head, but your listeners can check that out if they're interested more on that topic. But it really has to do with greed, with mind control, with manipulation of the public mind, and you know, who has the knowledge controls everything.
So do you feel like this is a very natural process, the manipulation and the hiding of the knowledge?
Yeah, I do. You know, and the experience from these substances is just so vast and so grand that to symbolize the object itself is like nothing, a mushroom on the ground. But when you include elves around this mushroom and you include Santa Claus and you include Jesus, and suddenly these things take on, fairy tales become legends and dogmas and religions that just take on a whole new level, you know. And I think originally, before writing, that wasn't the intention. I think that before writing, the stories were embellished so that the kids didn't forget. If you're given a bunch of false dogma and lies, then you're very easy to control, especially if you believe it and you're willing to die for it. You know, how easy is it to go run off and tell a bunch of dumb young kids, you know, you need to go in Iraq and kill these evil Muslims? And the same thing in the Islamic countries. You need to go off and kill these evil Christians. And both sides are equally as fanatical and maniacal. And in fact, if you look at historically, Christians have probably by far the record of just all-out massacre and genocide compared to the Islamic countries. Hitler was Christian. You know, Hitler worked with the Catholic Church, the Inquisitions, the Spanish and European Inquisitions wiped out, who knows, 60, 80, 100 million people. No other, even Genghis Khan can't argue those type of numbers. So, you know, historically speaking, it comes down to money and power and greed and control of the public mind.
How would changing the sacrament function in favor of the powers that be, or the powers that were at that time?
Yeah, well, changing it to a cracker or to a glass of wine. See, the problem is, and I think the CIA found this out in the 1960s with the MK Ultra program, and you know, the CIA was the first one that released LSD on the public. And they were some of the first down there in Mexico trying to acquire the mushrooms and all these different things, because they thought that they were going to be able to use these substances for mind control and for getting secret information out of people and things like that. But the problem was that every time they administered this stuff, or usually, the people woke up and realized what was happening to them. So it had the opposite effect. It seems to be a wake-up call, and people gain awareness of their surroundings and the things that are being perpetrated on them by people who have less than honest intentions.
So you feel but in a general, broad sense, if you take away the sacrament that gives you that sense,
well, then once again you can control the person, because they're eating a placebo. You know, they're not taking the real thing, so they're not going to have the real experience. And then what you can do is, at the same time, you're telling people, well, you eat this cracker and you drink this wine and you're going to be with God, and then people eat this placebo cracker that they bought at a liquor store, and they drink this $2 bottle of wine, and then they go, well, I didn't have my religious experience. And then, you know, the priest or whoever comes over, well, you're not believing, you know, you don't believe well enough, you're having doubt, and you know, you've got to have faith, and you've got to put your strength in God, and you know, they give you this whole guilt trip about it, and it further allows them to use this mind control and this manipulation of the public mind to their own advantage.
In the Pharmacratic Inquisition, you talk about mystery schools, and you talk about how this knowledge was secretly held by the priest class and the ruler class. And can you talk about why they would want to keep the mystery of knowledge of God to a very limited sect?
Well, the elitists have always seemed to have done that in patriarchal society. That's the mystery schools, the ancient cathedrals throughout Europe, those were really the universities. That's where the people went to learn the seven major forms of education, like astronomy and mathematics. And you know, there was seven primary things that people went and learned back then. And it all circles back to control. I mean, you know, me personally, having that type of knowledge, I wouldn't want to suppress it from other people, and I don't. It seems hard to understand why somebody who has this type of knowledge would want to suppress it from other people. But at the same time, and this is a question that I've come across many times over the years, and I've thought a lot about, and I've even gone, and a couple of other people have even suggested this as well, is that maybe even within the entheogens themselves there are yin and yang. The possibility is come up in my mind many times that that the possibly the Amanitas are more of a warring type of entheogenic substance, and in fact the Amanita muscaria has a lot of ties to the berserker raging of the Norse. Professor Ruck has some new evidence coming out to tie Amanita to some violent outbreaks. And my thing is it has the potential to occasion violent outbreaks. And then Amanita is red in color, and you have the polar opposite. You have the blue psilocybe. You know, and the blue psilocybe is, you know, very loving, very introspective, very, if you're doing bad things to other people, you pretty much have a miserable time on it. And that's one of the key factors in using entheogens, is knowing how people react to them and what's going on in their own lives. And when somebody tells me that, that somebody who's eaten psilocybe mushrooms and they're afraid to ever try them again, that tells me a lot about that person. You know, because the mushrooms don't create thoughts in your head. They bring forward suppressed subconscious thoughts. So if somebody is afraid to look in their own mind and face themselves, what does that tell you about that person? You know, it's kind of a frightening realization in and of itself. If you're true and honest with yourself, you should always be wanting to go in and look at yourself and analyze, you know, well, why did I have that bad trip? Why did I have those feelings about this or that? Not complete avoidance of your own subconsciousness. So to me, that just says, I need to back away from that person. Psychedelics and research is starting to become more and more open. I just received an email from MAPS today, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, and the number of studies that are happening in Israel and in Jordan and the U.S. and Canada, Sweden, Switzerland. I'm not sure about Sweden, but there's a lot of countries now that are beginning to re-examine the psychedelic issue that was so forcefully rejected immediately without just cause, with the fear of the Timothy Leary revolution of the 60s. And I think this time it's going to happen a little bit slower, and just in the last couple of weeks the United States Congress has decided to reanalyze if cannabis should be legal, and it absolutely should be. Nobody's ever died from it, and it's one of the safest substances known to humanity, and it certainly has medical value. That the U.S. government gives medical marijuana, the U.S. federal government gives medical marijuana to 7 patients, a couple of which I know personally, and yet they deny that marijuana has any medical value for the rest of the people in the country. It's this completely hypocritical stance. Excuse the Freudian slip or whatever it was. With all the studies coming out and with the reanalyzation of the legality of cannabis and state by state pushing for its legalization and churches gaining the right to use entheogens for religious sacraments, you know, it's slow, and I don't think we should have to be a member of a church to be allowed to experience our own spirituality. It's kind of a sad state of affairs when you have to belong to a religious organization to experience what is really something personal. And hopefully society as a whole will come more and more to that realization and stop being so fearful of things that they don't understand. You know, I said once in an interview, if you fear something, go out and read about it. Go out and buy books on it and study about it. If you fear LSD, go out and buy the books about LSD. If you fear the mushroom or the ayahuasca experience or the shamanic experience, go out and read about it, study about it, learn about it. Find out what your fears are really based on. Are they based on truth, on facts, or on your own ignorance and TV propaganda, government media?
Thank you. Yeah. We've been speaking with Jan Ervin about his research, and he's written a book with Andrew Rutaji, and it's called Astrotheology and Shamanism, Unveiling the Law of Duality in Christianity and Other Religions. Also, he has produced a DVD, the Pharmacratic Inquisition, also with his former partner, and it's also by the same name.
It's also got original audio from John Marco Allegro that was never before released until that. My website, GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com, or you can go to the PharmacraticInquisition.com. For the people who are who that long title frightens, www.pharmacratic-inquisition.com, INQUISITION.com.
Anybody in the listening audience is interested in making contact or has any questions, is there a way to get in touch with you?
Go to the website and just click contact and email me directly there, or you can contact me at jan@gnosticmedia.com.